Well, this is much better weather than last year. You'll be able to see your speaker today. This morning's speaker is our brother Tommy Asbell, and his subject is Europe, development of the frog spirits, leading the way to Armageddon. And he's asked that we start by reading in connection with his exhortation from Revelation 16, verses 12 to 16. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits, like frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth, and the whole world do gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Brother Tommy?
Morning. I've been found very enthusiastic about that. Thank you so much. That makes me feel better already. We're going to this morning we're going to be dealing with a lot of history and names and dates and things like that, not an overabundance of them, but some things. So if any of you are taking notes, then you want me to wait for you, just raise up your hand and I'll wait. So anyway, the subject matter that's been assigned to us for this morning is contained in the verses that were just read in your hearing, with particular emphasis on the frog spirit and how that demoniacal spirit manifests itself in such a fashion as to cause the convening or the assembly of the kings of the earth to do battle with the Ancient of Days in a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. We're going to begin this morning just a little bit off-center. And the reason we're going to do that is we want to be able to look at a much bigger picture rather than to focus in on these three frog-like spirits in this particular day and time. So, and I think that's where Brother Thomas had a distinct advantage over most of us today, because he was able to see a much bigger picture of the Scripture than we are. He had such a command of the Scripture that he could read something in Revelation and immediately he could see how it applied to the Old Testament, hence why he continually referred back to the prophets. And in, I believe it's in the first volume of Eureka, he referred to the apocalypse as revealed in the prophets. So anyway, we're going to stretch out a little bit and look at see if we can see a little bit bigger picture, which I think will maybe help us see this picture of the frog-like spirits just a bit more clearly. Now, throughout history, there have been events that have reshaped the lives of individuals, and they have reshaped the lives and the destiny of nations. And the nation of Israel is a good example. It's not what we're going to be talking about, but we would use the nation of Israel because we have a much longer history of the nation of Israel. We got 6,000 years that we can look at, whereas most nations, they come and they go, 200, 300, 400, 500 years, and then they're gone. But the nation of Israel has been around for a long time. And it seems that the whole existence of the nation of Israel, at least to me, has just been one tragic disaster after another throughout their entire history. They've had their own personal conflicts. They've had military conflicts, and then they have been conflicts where circumstances of divine consequence resulted in their in changes in their environment and in changes in their lives. And those were things, of course, over which they had no control. And in the book of Revelation, there are three events that have had and will have a cataclysmic impact on humankind, including, of course, the nation of Israel, each of which had and will have a frog spirit at its root. And we refer, of course, to the three great earthquakes of the apocalypse, the three great earthquakes of the apocalypse. There are, in fact, I think the word earthquake actually appears in the book of Revelation on five occasions. One of them has to do with an earthquake in Revelation, the 8th chapter and verse 5. Then there's mentions another earthquake, and it has reference to the third great earthquake. So there's actually three great earthquakes, then there's one earthquake, and then the other time the word earthquake is mentioned, it refers to the one in Revelation 16:17. Okay, so of this fourth particular earthquake that we're going to look at here for just a few minutes, and we're only going to spend just a very few minutes on it, it's found in the 8th chapter of Revelation in verse 5, and there that earthquake, it speaks of that earthquake that happened in AD 361. And Revelation 8:5 says, "And the angel took the censer, he filled it with fire off the altar, and he cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings, and there was an earthquake." Now the voices, the thunderings, and the lightnings are apocalyptic figures, and I want to stress that phrase apocalyptic figures, because in the apocalypse there's symbology and there's figures of speech in Revelation that you'll find nowhere else. Some of these things are peculiar to the book of Revelation, period. And we're going to be looking at a couple of those things. So when we say apocalyptic figures, it applies specifically to the book of Revelation. So then the voices, the thunderings, and the lightnings of Revelation 8:5 are apocalyptic figures that represent war, revolt, and of course, an earthquake represents political and social upheavals. Political and social upheavals. The time period of Revelation, the 8th chapter and verse 5, began shortly after the death of Constantine, which was in May the 22nd, 337 A.D. The actual time period of Revelation chapter 8 and verse 5 began in 340, 3 years, 2.5 years after Constantine died. The time period of Revelation 8:5 began 340 A.D. and it ended in 361, of the time period of 21 years. And it was during this time period, after Constantine had died, that his three sons took over the empire, and they were unable to maintain the integrity of the empire. And as a result, there were both internal and external conflicts. And finally, Julian, who was half-brother to the three sons of Constantine, came forward, and he was able to display just a remarkable ability both as a commander and as an administrator. And as a result, things then began to calm down in the Roman Empire. Calm down until Constantius, who was the middle son of Constantine, began to get jealous of Julian. And when he got jealous, civil war was on the horizon. It was just about to happen. And the only thing that prevented a new civil war was the fact that Constantius died. And it was at that time, in 361 A.D., that Julian renounced Christianity and attempted to reestablish paganism as the state's religion. And this event was deemed apocalyptically as an earthquake in Revelation 8, verse 5. So when Julian took over the empire in 361, he attempted to reestablish paganism as a state religion, and that was the apocalyptic earthquake of chapter 8. And this attempt to reinstitute paganism was pretty short-lived because Julian died 2 years later. And that was in June 26, 363 A.D. And here again, we'd like for you to note in Revelation 8, and if you don't have a note in your Bible someplace or in your notebook or something, I would appreciate it if you put a note in there that that word great is not associated with this earthquake of Revelation chapter 8, verse 5. This is not a great earthquake. There are three great earthquakes in Revelation. And it's not associated with the word earthquake. Great is not associated with the great with earthquake because it was a failed attempt to reverse a former earthquake that was in fact described as a great earthquake. And concerning that great earthquake, let's look over at Revelation, the sixth chapter. Revelation chapter 6, and we're going to read verses 12 through 17. Revelation 6, 12 through 17. This concerns the first great earthquake of the book of Revelation. And I beheld, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, the moon became as blood, the stars of heaven fell into the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places, and the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bond man, and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and the rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall stand? This great earthquake of verse 12 here in Revelation 6 is the first in the apocalypse. And as we read, the result of this upheaval was that the sun became black, the moon became as blood, the stars fell to earth, the heavens departed, the mountains and the islands were moved, kings, rich men, mighty men hid themselves and said that we'd rather die than suffer the indignities that awaited them by one who is apocalyptically described as the Lamb. And there's that phrase, apocalyptically described as the Lamb. And like we said earlier, the symbology many times in Revelation is peculiar unto itself. And such is true in some of the words that we just read here in the sixth chapter of Revelation. Other places in the scripture, the sun, the moon, the stars, and the heavens represent political and ecclesiastical systems, and here they do also. In this case, the entire paganistic system that had dominated Rome for centuries was now being brought to an end by the wrath of the Lamb. And apocalyptically, this Lamb is not Christ. This Lamb is Constantine. Apocalyptically, this Lamb is Constantine the Great. The time period of the opening of this sixth seal that we just read about was 312 A.D., and it continued for 12 years until 324 A.D. And at the beginning of this period, the Roman Empire was governed contemporaneously by four emperors. They were Maximin, Maxentius, Licinius, and Constantine. Maximin, Maxentius, Licinius, and Constantine. And it was through a series of civil wars that stretched throughout the time period of the Sixth Seal period where Constantine successively defeated his rival emperors, and the last was Licinius at the Battle of Adrianople, which gave Constantine control over not only Byzantium, but the entirety of the world. The whole Roman world became the domain of Constantine the Great. And Constantinople, or Byzantium rather, was renamed Constantinople, and it became the seat of the Eastern Dragon Power. Make a note of that or remember that. In 324 A.D., when Constantine defeated Licinius at the Battle of Adrianople, Byzantium became Constantinople, and it became the seat of the Eastern Dragon Power And that dragon power stood for 1,129 years, undefeated for 1,129 years. And anyway, here's a picture of Constantine up here, and I don't know if you can see it or not, but right across there, it says Constantine, by this sign, conquer, and we're going to look at that again in just a minute, a different slide of it. The means employed by Constantine to achieve these goals of conquest had mainly to do with his ability to champion the masses of Christianity and thereby gain the support and the participation of a community that had grown from only just a very few during the time of Christ and the time of the apostles to over 6 million. And I think the number was actually about 6.6 million. So at the time of Constantine, in about 311, 312, 313 A.D., the Christianity had grown from a very few to 6.6 million people. And Constantine was a man of great ability, diplomatic ability, and he was able to convince these so-called Christians to follow him. And we might note that in the beginning, these so-called Christians were primarily non-combatant, but believing that Constantine was somehow of divine manifestation and therefore the Lamb, they were quite willing to fight for him and with him. Those Christians who joined Constantine no doubt were apostates, but the promise of complete liberty and protection by a new government was an offer that they just couldn't resist. So then, believing that Constantine was the Lamb, and a victory over paganism would constitute the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, as manifest in the church with Constantine as its first Christian emperor, no doubt was the fulfillment of that for which they had hoped. And of course, that's all from the Catholic point of view. We don't necessarily subscribe to any of that. But the truth about Constantine, however, tells us a little bit different tale, because Constantine was just an extremely ambitious individual, and he was willing to use whatever means necessary to accomplish his personal ambition, which was mostly bound up in a desire to rule the then known world, which in fact he did. And one of these diabolical means that he used to achieve his personal goals, one of these diabolical means that he used or employed to claim, or he claimed that he had seen a vision of a cross with the inscription, "By this sign, conquer." And needless to say, those seeking freedom from pagan persecution thronged about him, and they praised his name. So Constantine to the Christian was definitely a hero. And in contrast to all that, let's look at what Hendrik van Loon said about Constantine. He says, "This wild Serbian, who had wielded a spear on every battlefield of Europe, from York in England to Byzantium on the shores of the Bosphorus, was among other things the murderer of his wife, the murderer of his brother-in-law, the murderer of his nephew, a boy of 7, and the executioner of several other relatives of minor degree and importance. He lived and died a barbarian who had outwardly accepted Christianity, yet until the end of his days he tried to read the riddle of the future in the steaming entrails of sacrificial sheep, which was most considerately overlooked in view of his Edict of Tolerance." The point is that Constantine's Edict of Milan, and we say Edict of Milan instead of Edict of Edict of Toleration, in 311 A.D., Emperor Galerius wrote an edict, and it was called the Edict of Tolerance. And then in 313, Licinius and Constantine also wrote the Edict of Milan. The Edict of Milan was an expansion of the Edict of Tolerance. The Edict of Milan was, in fact, an Edict of Tolerance, but it was not the Edict of Tolerance. So anyway, but this Edict of Milan did in fact grant a lot of freedom to the Christians, And it also said that anything that had been property, money, or anything that had been confiscated by the state from the Christians, the Edict of Milan granted all that money and wealth and land and whatever kind of property they had back to the Christians, and it granted them religious freedom. And that's why these people were so willing to follow Constantine, because they had been slaves and persecuted for all those years up until that time, and they were ready for freedom. They were ready to be free from all that. So then the point is that Constantine's Edict of Milan was seen as a rallying standard that had the power to bring into real existence that which the masses desired, namely liberty from freedom from the bonds of paganism. So this first great earthquake was pivotal in solidifying in the minds of the masses that certain ideologies could in fact be achieved. Although not specifically identified as such, that spirit of liberalism and freedom was certainly a precursor to the frog spirit, whose beginnings wouldn't be far away. So this desire to be free from the persecution of the pagans was in the minds of all these Christians. If we follow Constantine, then we can be free from all these things, because that's what we want. We want liberty, and we want freedom from all these persecutions. And that's, in fact, just exactly what they got, so they thought. But they were satisfied with it. Okay, so then, that then was an example of a frog-like spirit that was associated with the first great earthquake, although the word frog spirit is not mentioned in the sixth chapter of Revelation. Okay, let's go now and look at the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation. Begin reading in verse 1. We're going to read through 13. Revelation 11, 1 through 13. There was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God, and the altar, and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple leave out, and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over the waters to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and shall kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. And they of the people and the kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3.5 days, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put into graves. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. And after 3.5 days, the Spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet. And great fear fell upon them which saw them. And they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, Come up hither. And they ascended up to the heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. And the same hour there was a great earthquake, and the tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake were slain of men 7,000, and the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to the God of heaven. These verses speak of events that concern the death and the resurrection of the two witnesses who lay dead in the streets of that great city from the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which was in 1685 AD, until the time of the French Revolution, and we'll date it at 1790, or 105 years, or 3.5 day years, or 3.5 typical days, which are 105 years, at which time, at that time, there was a great earthquake. And this second great earthquake was an upheaval that spiraled out of control for about 4 years. And if we include the Napoleonic Wars, the whole affair lasted about 30 years, with aftershocks that have continued now for more than 220 years. And of course, we refer to the French Revolution. The French Revolution and the events which brought it into full manifestation, and the impact of the demon-like spirits in modern political and diplomatic arenas, will be the focus of our attention for the next little while. But keep in mind that we're attempting to trace the frog spirit, its influence then and now, and not so much the details of the French Revolution itself. So we're not necessarily interested in all the Robespierre and all the massacre that went on and the guillotines and all that stuff. So we're interested in the beginning of the frog-like spirits. So that's what we're going to be focusing on more than anything else. And I think that before we can really fully appreciate the latter-day impact of these frog-like spirits, that it might be well if we spent some time in an effort to clearly identify, one, where the frog spirits originated, two, what it consists of, and three, how it developed. So first, we all understand, and we should understand when we read the Apocalypse, that these frog spirits just don't simply appear in Revelation 16th chapter. They just don't mysteriously appear prior to Armageddon, but rather, the involvement of the frog-like spirits in the prophecy of the sixth vial period is a result of 15 centuries of unwitting preparation. The frog spirits have been in preparation for 15 centuries prior to the time of Revelation, the 16th chapter. Now, in 1996, in Reims, France, there was a celebration of the 1500th anniversary of the conversion to Catholicism by Clovis, king of the ancient barbarian Franks. And this is an advertising poster showing the king of the Franks there, which is in the middle, and he's got frogs on his uniform. He's actually got five of them there that you can see. And anyway, that's Clovis dressed in the frogs. And this also is a picture of Clovis holding his staff, and it's got a fleur-de-lis up on the end of his staff there. And during this celebration in 1996 in Reims, there were on display in a place called the Palais du Temple, which is the residence of the Archbishop of Reims. And inside the building, this building right here, inside that building there are a number of these huge tapestries on the walls of the hallways in there, and some of them are like 20 by 20 or 20 by 30, and they are just massive tapestries. And on these tapestries, this is just a detail of one of those, and there's a banner with three frogs, here's another one over here, and there's actually two right here in the middle. And right here, there's actually another banner with three fleur-de-lis on there, and we'll talk about that directly. So the point is that as far back as 496 AD, the Frankish king Clovis chose the symbol of the frogs to represent the barbarian tribes of Westphalia marshlands. And this is over the doorway of one of the buildings that is adjacent to the cathedral at Notre Dame there at Reims, and this Palais du Temple. And you can notice above the door here that what it actually says is liberty, equality, and fraternity. Another point worthy of inclusion at this place is a quote from Gerald Simmons from the book Barbarian Europe. And he says that they stubbornly clung to their talking about the Franks, Clovis, the king of the Franks. He says they stubbornly clung to their tribal attitudes towards law and the rights of individuals and thereby preserved a priceless tradition until the time for democracy was ripe. They led all others in personal freedom, the very concept of progress, the belief in the inevitable and continuous betterment of man can be traced to ideas born in a barbarian epoch. So this, then, we're talking about the birth of the frog-like spirits, the birth of freedom, the birth of liberty, and the birth of fraternity. It goes back as far as 496 A.D. And this is from Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon. He also speaking of the Franks. He says, the love of liberty was the ruling passion of the Frankish barbarians who originated in Westphalia, Germany. They deserved, they assumed, they maintained the honorable epitaph of Franks or freemen. The Franks framed their laws, appointing four venerable chieftains to compose them, and then submitting these draft laws for approval by three successive assemblies of the people. So they were attempting to establish as much liberty and equality amongst the people as they possibly could. So here again, this is the beginnings, we think, of the frog spirits, and their full and complete manifestation, of course, erupted in 1790, several hundred years later, 1,500 years later, as a matter of fact, in 1996. And anyway, the word Franks is from the Latin Francus, and it means free. So these same free and warlike barbarians, as Gibbon describes them, overran Gaul, which at that time encompassed France, Luxembourg, Belgium, and Switzerland, and at last, of course, the Roman Empire in the West. These Franks conquered Rome eventually, but somehow the Roman priesthood managed to conquer them, as is witnessed by the baptism of Clovis, and this is a statue commemorating the baptism of Clovis here, and that was in 496 A.D. And thanks to Brother Al Bryan, we have this picture here. This is in Innsbruck, Austria, I believe is where that statue is. And anyway, this is a picture of Clovis, and you can see on his shield right here, on this side, on the left side of the shield there are three fleur-de-lis, and on the other side of it, there's three frogs on the other side. So the frogs then represent the barbaric people on the shield, while the fleur-de-lis stand for the nobility or the aristocracy of that age. And the fleur-de-lis later became associated with the Catholic Church. And then around 1376 A.D., King Charles V, and this is the seal of King Charles V, and you can see all the fleur-de-lis on both sides of his seal there. And in 1376, King Charles V dedicated the symbol of the three fleur-de-lis to the Trinity. So when we see these symbols with the fleur-de-lis on them, especially three on a shield or on a banner or something like that, in the Catholic system, it represents the Trinity. And once you start looking at things like this, then you start seeing fleur-de-lis everywhere. And I saw a lady walking down the street the other day, and she had these things all over her. Probably didn't have a clue as to what they meant, but these lily flowers she had all over her dress. So then it seems reasonable to me to assume then that these three frog-like spirits would represent a barbaric, rebellious, liberty-inspired ideology, while at the same time the fleur-de-lis seems to represent pretty much the opposite, and that being the religious, civil, and social aspects of the French hierarchy who are responsible for holding in check anything that would interfere with the established way of life and their method of ruling. So then the point of this dissertation here is to show that the spirit of liberty is a way of life that takes centuries to permeate the minds of men and even longer to materialize into an actual revolution. And case in point, of course, is the French Revolution. Now, There was an era in European history, and it lasted from the 14th to the 17th centuries, and it was known as the Renaissance. And Renaissance roughly means new birth or a new beginning or to be born again. And as a cultural movement, it encompassed a flowering of literature, science, art, religion, and politics, along with a gradual but widespread educational reform. And that's of particular significance with regards to this movement of freedom, because it's when you educate the middle classes, then they become considerably more intelligent, then they have different desires, they're no longer satisfied to do the things and be slaves that they had always been. Now they have all this education, and now they want freedom. The frog spirit was hard at work in that era, especially in the areas of politics, religion, and educational awakenings. And it's during this rebirth that there arose another era, a more troubling era, and it was known as the Reformation. And here again, the frog spirit was alive and well in men like John Calvin and Martin Luther, who objected to the corrupt doctrine and the practice of the Catholic organization. And these protests can be seen in Martin Luther's 95 Theses. The spirit of liberty, as symbolized by the three-frog banner, was now becoming an obsession, a persistent, disturbing preoccupation, often with the ideas or feelings of an unreasonable nature. And when we look at the French Revolution and what was actually going on in the French Revolution, it's important to note that things were completely out of control. There was no organization to this revolution. All they wanted to do was go in there and take the hierarchy out, and then we'll decide what to do afterwards. So it was mass murder everywhere. And we note in that 11th chapter of Revelation that we read there, it said that there were 7,000 killed, and I think probably that number 7,000 there represents the total number of the hierarchy, because there were considerably more people killed in the French Revolution in Paris than just those 7,000. So I think that's a representative number of the hierarchy that was all taken out of the way and all the government officials, because the number was considerably higher than that, 40 to 50,000, I believe. This was all manifest during the years of 1789 to 1794. The French Revolution was a radical social, political, and religious upheaval. And in the first 3 years of the revolution, the old hierarchy and tradition crumbled under the weight of the new enlightenment with ideas of liberty, citizenship, and inalienable rights. And this is the Declaration of the Revolution, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, and it's dated August the 26th, 1789. So then changes in civil, social, religious, economic, and political systems can be seen as having an ism, and I want to emphasize that these isms play a very important part in the latter-day manifestation of the frog-like spirits. So changes in civil, social, religious, and economic and political systems can be seen as having an ism as a motivating source that plunges both men and kingdoms headlong into demoniacal conflicts. Isms like socialism, communism, liberalism, nationalism, and probably any other number of isms that you could think of. These are described in Revelation, the 16th chapter, in verse 14, as the spirits of demons. The spirits of demons. Let's look over at the book of James for just a minute. The spirit of demons. James chapter 3, verses 15 and 16. This wisdom, and he's talking about in verse 14, he says, "But if you have bitter envyings and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth," and so forth. In verse 15, he says that this kind of fleshly human thinking, or this wisdom, descendeth not from above, but rather that kind of thinking is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. And that's exactly what was going on in the world of the French Revolution. There was every evil thought imaginable. In the times of Jesus and the apostles, people who may have been mentally ill were thought to have an evil spirit, that is, an unclean spirit, or they were possessed of some sort of a demon. Devils and demons are defined by Strong's as a supernatural spirit of a bad nature, kind of like a devil with an attitude. But in connection with these demonized spirits, James associates the word confusion. And the Greek word for confusion is akatastasia, and the word means instability, disorder, tumult, and commotion. And Vine's dictionary adds to that definition, and he says that we can include anarchy and revolution with this confusion. And as something of a side note here, in Egyptian mythology, there was an Egyptian god who is depicted many times with the head of a frog. And in Egyptian mythology, he was known as the god of chaos. And that's him. So that just, it kind of associates chaos with the frog. Okay, so now I think we can begin to associate this unstable, anarchical, tumultuous, radical, chaotic, and nationalistic ideology of the frog-like spirits with its latter-day counterparts, and primary among them, at least for the time being, is this European state whose association with the three frogs is most conspicuous, namely Catholic France. The French Revolution was a watershed, or it was a turning point in European history, and it marked the end of what the French referred to as the ancient regime. And LaRousse, in his book called Modern History, says, in a political sense, it is still proper to date the age in which we live from the French Revolution. The shock carried by that revolution and the spread of its principles has produced repercussions ever since. And I might tell you that that was probably written in the mid-19th century, because LaRouche died in 1875. But nonetheless, what he says here is just as applicable today as it was back then, because the shock waves that were produced by the French Revolution have an impact on us every day. And that's exactly what's going on in Europe right now. That's why the Pope is doing what he's doing. That's why the nations are gathering themselves together, because of the repercussions that were produced, that started the time period of the French Revolution. So it doesn't make any difference when he wrote that. It applies today. So these carried over principles then have permeated and transformed every aspect of the lives of our lives, politics, economics, education, inventions, industry, arts, science, ethics, and religion. The seeking for of liberty has seen virtual miracles performed in every avenue of social and political life. The net result, however, of all that glorious ideal of liberty has in fact produced a putrid and evil corruption that will eventually lead to the collapse of civilization as we know it, just as the Apostle John records in Revelation 16, and that collapse will in fact begin with Armageddon. The French manifestation of the frog-like spirits has been seen in its diplomatic activity and provocative meddling in the affairs of nations for many years. That demon-like frog spirit or influence can be historically documented as having been involved in the European revolutions of 1820, 1830, 1848, the Papal War of 1867, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Gulf War. French involvement has produced or helped get all these revolutions and these wars underway. So the French involvement is seen in all those things, and time is not going to permit us to detail each involvement by France in the aforementioned wars, but this is at least right here a partial list of some of the documentation about that. And I don't know where I got this, but this is a Truth Cleaner magazine from 2010, And Brother Pye has an article in here about the frog-like spirits, and he documents in this magazine a lot of the things that we're going to be saying, and he quotes from a lot of those books. So if you don't have that, get it and read it. It's Brother Pye did a good job there. Today, the most predominant factor, at least in my opinion, on the frog spirits agenda is anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. The most predominant factor on the frog spirits agenda is anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Although the Jewish population in France is only about 1%, or I think that's around 800,000 Jews, this 1% of the population in France is in constant contention with mostly anti-Semitic French society, many of whom are resident Muslims, which makes the matter even worse. In the last few years, Jewish synagogues have been firebombed. Young Jewish men have been attacked in public. Jewish rabbis have warned them to wear hats over their yarmulkes to be as inconspicuous as they possibly could. How many of you know what happened on the night of the broken glass? Okay. It happened in Germany, and all the shops and the stores and the possessions of the Jews were taken. They were put into ghettos. And when I read things like this about what's going on in Paris, in France, it reminds me of the night of the broken glass. In April 2002, Eli Yeshai, minister of the Israeli Interior and leader of the ultra-Orthodox Shah's party, offered those French Jews living in France $9,000 apiece to immigrate. And at present, we think that only about 20% of those resident French Jews intend to leave France. So they are going to stay put, and they're going to be continue to live in that sort of environment, in that anti-Semitic environment. And one of the main problems is that the French local authorities seem to turn a deaf ear to the complaints of the Jews, and the seriousness of these matters is largely overlooked. And this quote from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs under the heading of French Anti-Semitism, a Barometer for Gauging Society's Perverseness, is an article by Manfred Gerstenfeld, and he gives us an indication of how anti-Semitism is handled there by local officials. It says, the mechanism to suppress police information about anti-Semitic acts is simple. In France, a complaint to a police office may be written only by hand by the policeman on duty in a register called the main courtant. This inscription is an official, is not an official act, and does not lead to prosecution. The police commissary decides what is considered an incident and its nature, and facts from the register are often not reported to the interior minister, as the commissary does not want to inform that there is increasing insecurity in his area of responsibility. On a much larger scale, however, and directly involved in European thinking about anti-Semitism, which we think will greatly aid in bringing about the collecting of nations for Armageddon, in part, is France's diplomatic stand on anti-Zionism and the influence it exerts on the remainder of the European Union. And we have a group of slides here, which is from the Hudson Institute. And the Hudson Institute is an American think tank that was founded back in 1961. And we're at 10 o'clock now. Do we need to stop? 10 more minutes? 10:10. Okay. Okay. This is from the Hudson Institute. And one of the writers says, and it's talking about Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, and we're talking about anti-Semitism. He says, as soon as Sarkozy was elected president of France, he appointed Jean David Levitt as his personal diplomatic advisor. Levitt was also a former diplomatic advisor to Jacques Chirac, the worst anti-Zionist president ever in France. So, and I don't know if you ever read much about Sarkozy or not, but one of the first things he said when he got into office was, he says, I am a friend of the Jews. I am a friend of the Jews. And he turns right around, he appoints John David Levitt, personal advisor to Jacques Chirac, the worst anti-Zionist president in France ever. Sarkozy's second day in office, he chose Hubert Védrine as foreign affairs minister, who used to be a socialist foreign minister and probably the most hostile person to Israel since World War II. Védrine now courts Hamas and Hezbollah. In April 2010, Sarkozy came to Washington, D.C., and there he agreed with Obama about freezing construction in Jerusalem and supported and reinforced Obama's angry overreaction, helping to deepen the crisis between Israel and the rest of the world. And this, I thought, was kind of strange for another advisor to say. Anyway, it says, another advisor to Sarkozy, which is Jacques Attali, replied when asked by the Israeli Daily News Network if anti-Semitism were a problem in France, and he said, zero, none whatsoever. It's a lie. It's a pure lie. Not true. I think it's propaganda, Israeli propaganda. And one of the staff writers' comments concerning anti-Semitism, he said, it is media brainwashing that enables the French to mask their politically incorrect and politically incorrect anti-Semitism behind their politically correct hatred for Israel. Israelis say the Muslim world is a proven enemy that shows more and more its true face, namely the European Union and its main members. The European Union, France, the UK, and some other European countries, Spain, for example, are not only the scene of rising anti-Semitism, they also behave as if one of their primary objectives now is to demonize, or the demonization and the destruction of the nation of Israel. And there's a footnote down at the bottom there who explains what the Hudson Institute is. It says the Hudson Institute is a nonpartisan policy research organization dedicated to the innovative research and analysis and promotes global security and prosperity and freedom. So then we think then that the matter of the frog-like spirits is quite unambiguous in these last times, as their objectives, we think, are pretty clearly stated. Now, we've not said much about papal involvement in anti-Semitism, but the Catholic Church's record on the subject is a matter of history. The Jews were blamed by the Catholics with everything from the murder of Christ. They were blamed for the Black Plague. They were blamed for World War II, World War I, communism, black slavery, war with Iraq, 9/11, the Jews were blamed with Katrina and its aftermath, and now the Jews are being blamed for the Holocaust. Can you imagine that? The Jews being blamed for the Holocaust? And that was a little guy down in Texas that said that. Catholic involvement with Nazi Germany is documented in hundreds of pictures, and you've probably all seen them. Many showing Catholic priests giving the Nazi salute while standing alongside German officers. And in this picture here, you can see a couple of Catholic priests on the other side over there. They look a little half-hearted in their salutes, but nonetheless, they're associated with the Nazis, and we know these are not just German officers, because this guy right here, that's Joseph Goebbels, and he definitely was a Nazi. And in that picture, it's Adolf Hitler and probably Archbishop whoever. But anyway, it represents the association of the Catholic Church with Nazism and anti-Semitism. At present, Catholicism is denying any involvement in anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism, and they don't have to be involved in it anymore because they've got the rest of Europe taking up the sword for them. The rest of Europe, the Middle East, has taken over that task for them. In 2009, Pope Benedict had a meeting with American Jews, and he said, in that meeting, he said, denial of the Holocaust is intolerable and unacceptable. And there are just a lot of neo-Nazis new thinkers that are going around saying that the Holocaust never happened. Well, the Pope has now taken up the sword. He says, yes, denial of the Holocaust is unthinkable. It's unacceptable. And in that same meeting, the Pope also said that anti-Semitism is a crime. That anti-Semitism is a crime. This, we think, will help clear out the slate where the false prophet can become more involved in the diplomatic arena where it works best, as the papacy ties together the dragon power and the European beast through its policy and its practice. And these photos give us some sort of an idea of the papacy's intention as the Pope visits with the dragon and with the beast. And of course, this is Benedict with Vladimir Putin, with Sarkozy, and with Angela Merkel. So what we've got here is the Pope associating himself with the dragon and with the beast. That's the two-horned beast that you're looking at right there, or at least part of it. And then as we look at these things, then we begin to look at these things, these photos give us an idea of the papacy's intention as the Pope visits with the dragon and the beast, and while these strategic maneuvers are being manifest, the words of Brother Thomas should come ringing in our ears. Brother Thomas comments on Revelation chapter 16 and verse 15, which says, "Behold, I come as a thief." This is from Eureka, Volume 5, page 230, the Logos edition of it. Brother Thomas says, "The prophecy seems to require a simultaneous going forth of all three demon-like spirits to the kings of the earth and of the whole habitable to convene them contemporaneously to encounter some great and urgent danger that threatens, if not overcome, to subvert and to destroy all their legitimate interests. Among the influences brought into exceeding prominent activity will doubtless be the Franco-Papal or the unclean frog-like demon spirit that issues forth from the mouth of the false prophet. The position of this announcement of the thief-like advent in the prophecy is remarkable. It stands between the going forth of the frog-like spirits and the gathering of the kings into Armageddon. This indicates that the advent takes place before the gathering into that place or country." So Brother Thomas is saying that before Armageddon begins, that during the outworking of these frog-like spirits, the advent will take place. And I'm here to tell you that that could be today. That's how close we are. He says, when the crisis is formed, the prophet of that great city will be in high feather, exerting himself in the presence of the beast with all the spiritual influence he possesses over the millions of anti-Christendom to induce them to join. I'm having a little trouble reading that. It's 15 feet away. To induce them to join in the crusade preached as the great rally, as this grand rally of the earth and the whole habitable against the great and pressing terror of the situation. He says, but what is that great terror that throws the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet into such tumultuous alarm that there are several governments should seek to excite the whole world simultaneously to war? It's that. So the question is then, where do we then as believers stand in this time frame of the three frog-like spirits? Brother Thomas suggests that the frog-like spirits are divided into three phases. We now live in the end of the second phase. The third phase of the frog-like spirits will come when the three spirits speak simultaneously, as Brother Thomas pointed out in what we just read. The point is that we stand on the very threshold of the Lord's advent when the trump of God will sound and the time of the dead ones shall have arrived. So I think we'll stop right there.